Hiranyakasipu being a materialistic person is the prototype of one who invests all his energy into the material realm. And to Hiranyakasipu, the material realm was fine. Fundamentally, it was okay. There was just one issue, that, namely, death. And if death would be overcome, then really nothing was lacking. Then everything was fine. Material enjoyment was indeed the perfection of life. And if simply there was enough wealth and enough sexual enjoyment, then everything was great. Therefore, Hiranyakasipu was very determined to become immortal. Existentialist philosophers have exposed that approach of Hiranyakasipu. We see in a book of Simone de Beauvoir, there is a man in the Middle Ages who is discovering the elixir of immortality, and somehow or other by an alchemical process. So he takes it, he drinks it, and he becomes immortal. But he's not sure that it really works. So he tests it on a mouse. He makes some contraption, puts the mouse in there, crushes the mouse, and then the mouse, whoop, re-emerges. So he knows that I'm immortal. And he also realizes there and then that he has to live forever with a mouse. Right. So it carries on from that point where at one point he is trying to enter into different types of enjoyment, and he enters into different relationships, and he loves his wife very much and his children very much, but he doesn't love anyone that much that he wants to give them immortality. So they die, and he doesn't, and his sons are getting upset that he's not dying. They try to even poison him. Hare Krishna. They try to even poison him, and but to no avail. He doesn't die, which becomes a major disturbance. Anyway, in the end of the book, the man has lost all interest in doing anything at all, in taking any initiative, and he just sees any activity as pointless, and he cannot see any sense for endeavoring in this world, because all enjoyment is futile. But meanwhile, so in this book of Simone de Beauvoir, the man who reached immortality is really imprisoned in his own invention. He's brought doom upon him because he's eternally to reside in the material world. But this is exactly what Hiranyakasipu wants. He wants that immortality. To him, there is nothing wrong with the material world. It's great. It's wonderful. It's only death that is really the obstacle. Otherwise, no obstacle at all. Everything is fine. This is the illusory energy. This is a person who has become overwhelmed by the material energy, and who has fallen into the trap of the unlimited nature of the material energy. It is explained that Lord Krishna has three energies, the Antaranga Shakti, the Tatastha Shakti, and the Bahirangi Shakti, or the internal energy, the marginal energy, and the external energy. And in the Bhagavad Gita, we find that the external energy is described as consisting of 8 elements, Bhumi, Rapo, Nalo, Vayu, Kama, Nabudre, Vacha, and so on. And then in the next verse, it is said, Apareyam itastvanyam prakritim vidime param jiva bhuta mahabaho yayedam dayate jagat, which establishes that yet there is a higher energy than this external energy, and that is the living being. So the living being is placed in a higher category than the external energy. But yet the external energy has the, although it's of a lower nature, can overpower the living being, which is a somewhat puzzling question. Why is it that the living being, if he's of a higher nature, can become overpowered by this lower energy? What gives this lower energy its extraordinary power? But it is explained because the material energy is the reflection of the unlimited spiritual energy. Therefore, it borrows from the spiritual energy all this unlimited variety, and therefore it has the power to create the illusion that there is unlimited opportunity in this world to enjoy. And Hiranyakasipu fell in that trap, in the trap to actually believe that there is unlimited opportunity to enjoy. That's not a fact. We are rather very, very limited. I'll quote something from Gandhi. Gandhi was saying that human beings by nature are very limited, or living beings, but he spoke about human beings. And he said, by nature, we are not able to have relationship with many things or with many people. He said, by nature, we can maybe relate to just our family members and our immediate environment. He said, but now in modern times, we're traveling at the at an inconceivable speed with trains, right, which was 60 kilometers an hour. And his point was, and therefore our whole social life is now become unnatural. And Prabhupada oftentimes made that point, that in modern times with this society based on cars, all our relationships are spread out at 100 kilometers this way, so many that way, and all over the place, and we don't know our neighbors. So Gandhi's point then, to go back to him, was that therefore all speed faster than walking was wrong. Which, you know, I mean, it's got some merit to it. It's interesting that that was fundamentally wrong. I thought that was interesting, especially the speed that we live in or with these days is inconceivable. The global village and all that. So Gandhi's mode of life at something interesting. Srila Prabhupada, coming from the same Indian tradition, had the same observation about modernity, the world we live in. And this whole world is styled after the Hiranyakasipu mentality. More and more enjoyment, faster, more variety, as much as possible. As much as possible. So the same mood. There's nothing wrong with the material world. It's great. Our only problem is we don't have enough time to enjoy it all. And therefore, we should live faster, move faster, communicate faster, just multitask so that we can simultaneously enjoy with all the senses. Why only one? one particular set of senses. No, all of them simultaneously, if possible, and then to the max. We have to boost it up in various ways so that the enjoyment is not of an ordinary nature, but that it is like extremely distilled and very powerful and boosted up to the max. Right. And thus we have shops where they sell pills which show pictures of men with huge muscles, and I just in London drove past a whole shop just dedicated to that. Yeah, it's kind of like, okay, a few bottles on the shelf, but a whole shop. Right? It's just like it's so in this way, it just the same mentality to increase our potential for material enjoyment is so much in the forefront of our civilization, a misguided, a misdirected civilization. The last few days, I was in Oxford in a room, and in a room that was filled with books about hermits and monasteries, and I got a bit in the mood. Of course, I'm far from that, but so something about there was a list of the daily program of Zen monks, some basic principles. And one of these principles was no multitasking, yeah, which I thought is a very interesting point. No multitasking. Whatever you do, do never more than one thing at a time. Well, it's so alien to the modern lifestyle, which is rather the opposite. With your iPhone, you can continuously stay in communication with the world while you are doing a million other things, and it's just multitasking is the very basis of our lifestyle. So it was just interesting. So sometimes you wonder, do we have an exalted philosophy but a Hiranyakasipu lifestyle? In maybe not in the sense of sense gratification directly, but still in that kind of high pace which is born from the Hiranyakasipu mentality. So in some ways we may wonder. The sages of Srimad Bhagavatam were living very different from in a very different model from we modern men. Even 500 years ago, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and his associates lived very different. Even Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur started out very different by taking the same vow as Haridas Thakur and also Bhaktivinoda Thakur. Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur gave to Srila Bhaktisiddhanta a set of beads on which he had chanted a vow of chanting a billion names in 3 years by chanting 100,000 names, 300,000 names a day. And then Srila Bhaktisiddhanta took up the same vow. So coming from that very renounced, reclusive type of background, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta built a bridge to modernity, and as he built that bridge, he went over that bridge and started to function in modern times and paved the way for the modern model of Vaishnavism, and then we see Srila Prabhupada and Satsarup Maharaj coined the phrase Jet Age Parivrajak Acharya, And then we see how Srila Prabhupada managed to do that, right? Which is still a miracle, right? When we think about it, how he could do both, right? Be deep and very contemplative in his writing time, writing purports full of very deep absorption, and yet be so much part of the overwhelming world with which moves at such a fast pace of interaction and impressions that it's difficult for ordinary people to concentrate on anything. It's only possible for one who is so deeply absorbed on the transcendental plane, so deeply absorbed in love of God, to function like that. It certainly is a challenge for us. It certainly is a challenge for us to go deep and at the same time so broad in the lifestyle that we have. Run from here to there and from this to that and all the engagements. And we are feeling the pinch, so to speak, and are sometimes wondering if this movement eventually has to also develop other aspects of renunciance, of the more reclusive type who at the depth. After all, in our tradition, that was very much so. Looking at some of our acharyas, they were very deep and great reclusive personalities. Back to really the theme of the verse is Hiranyakasipu's drive for material immortality. Our activity in this world is although externally similar, in an external sense we may be just as busy with material energy as the Hiranyakasipus in this world. Our objective is obviously different. Our objective is to establish the glories of the Supreme Lord. And therefore, in the cause of establishing the glories of the Supreme Lord, the result is different. The result is that our activities, although externally the same, are offered in devotional service. And as a result, they are purifying and elevating and are increasing our attachment to Krishna. And thus, one can live in the middle of the world and engage all the various aspects of this world in the service of Krishna. When it comes to devotional service, Srila Jiva Goswami has established in his Bhakti Sandarbha that all service must be preceded and followed by the chanting of the holy name. So although we may say that all our activities are transcendental in devotional service, still that particular injunction that all activities must be preceded and followed by the chanting of the holy name is stressing the need to make direct time for Krishna, or time to associate with Krishna directly. And that this time is essential. And that specifically, okay, we do so in chanting the holy name. And along with that chanting, there may be other supportive activities. For example, rising early, Brahma Muhurta, cleanliness, being in a suitable place. For example, I avoid traveling in the early mornings, although I did today, because it interferes with chanting. And chanting on an airport is not very nice. It's not a conducive place for chanting. Of course, when one is experienced, one can even find some corners there where it is better than in others. But to chant in the middle of a shopping mall is not ideal. It's just like, and really, airports are shopping malls these days. So, what to do? Like that, we must certainly protect our spiritual practices. That is essential. If we do not protect our spiritual practices, it becomes difficult. And these days, the material world even comes into one's hermitage. One can hide in a room with pictures of Krishna in all directions, but then there is a cable or a wireless that enters into that room. And as soon as you turn on the beast, right, then suddenly there it is. The material influence is right there, present in the middle of our morning sadhana, and while downloading the holy name is sort of chanted. That could happen. There is a need for some sanctity in our life in the midst of all the insanity. After all, this world is a world based on ukra karma. One could say something like, on an ukra karma morning, we woke to another ukra karma day and started. Went to our Ugra Karma bathroom and put some Ugra Karma chemicals on our teeth and so on. Everything is touched by this Ugra element, horrible works meant to destroy the world, Ugra Karma. We wear clothes full of artificial elements in it, which are really not so healthy. The paint on the wall is outright toxic. The chemicals on the food, the Greenpeace poster on the wall said equals or is equivalent to 20 aspirins in one meal. Bon appetit. The genetically manipulated soy milk also doesn't, which of course helps for cholesterol, but I don't know what else it helps for. I can imagine that mutants will appear. So it's sometimes strange to live in this world and to try and live a Vaishnava lifestyle, where we are externally sort of squeezed into the mold of Hiranyakasipu, and then utilize whatever products are coming from the Hiranyakasipu society and try to engage them in the service of the Lord. And with that, we push on the mission. And with that, we fight fire with fire. And with that, we are using computers, we are using cars, we are using planes, we are using cell phones, which sort of melt the walls of the brain cells, so they say, and will create an incredible percentage of senile people at quite an early age. And meanwhile, we're trying to utilize all these things to get rid of all these things. Ultimately, our objective is to create a world which has no planes, which has no computers, which has no iPhones, which has no cars, which has no guns, which has none of these things. And it's simply a much more, a culture much closer to nature. It's interesting that in doing that, we are so entrenched in the modern lifestyle. I'm not caring right now about the condition of the earth. I'm caring more about the condition of our spiritual life. So please don't ask me things about ecology at the end of this lecture. Whatever you do. That's not the theme. So questions that are not on the theme will not be entertained. I'm only interested in the theme of what are we going to make of our spiritual life? And I would just want to put the question, should we somehow or other create, make a conscious endeavor to create a sacred space in which we can, which is a little bit aloof from the modernity, where we have an opportunity to really cultivate an in-depth practice of chanting, of hearing, chanting, and remembering, so that we can bring that back into our preaching. So in other words, my angle is spiritual nourishment, the need for spiritual nourishment, living in the, trying to practice bhakti yoga in the Hiranyakasipu Ugra Karma society, and how it's a balance. My question is, are we keeping the balance? I read in Burijan's Bhagavatam study guide where he explained that balance is like, keeping balance is like riding a bicycle. So there is no, at no point in time is there a fixed position that keeps the balance when riding a bicycle. So one cannot say, here is the balance. It's balance in motion. And on the bicycle, one constantly finds the balance in another way. And one's body will adjust according to the position of the bike. So that's interesting, that keeping a balance is also balance in motion. So it means that sometimes one activity will get the emphasis and sometimes another activity will get the emphasis. But in the overall, it seems to me that we'd better reserve some emphasis for in-depth quality spiritual practice, so that we are, and I think that's regardless of ashram, so that first of all we will spiritually survive, and second of all that that we'll have some substance in presenting this mission, now that Hari Sori Prabhu is here, then naturally you think of Prabhupada and like this, and it's like stories about serving Prabhupada. And I'm thinking of the story which I'll ask him to tell, because How can I tell a Hari Suri story in his presence? But where Prabhupada said, how can you preach, right? You said you wanted to preach, and then he said something like, how can you preach? What can you preach? You remember? Is that enough, or should I give more of a... Is it? Well, that you just you expressed a desire to preach, to go out and preach, and that Prabhupada ultimately said, "What preaching can you do? And what will?" He said, "Actually, you're not preaching. Actually, I am preaching." Yeah, nice. Thank you very much. Yeah, I like the story, of course, you know. And when we remember these stories, they have a life of their own, you know, like, because it wasn't our experience, right? So they change a little bit in emphasis and in experience. So it's nice to hear it directly. But... yeah, so I thought that was maybe a little relevant to this lecture, because the tension point between going out to preach and being third class is exactly sort of where it's at. And of course, Srila Prabhupada pointed out that he did say that he wanted us to at least come to the Madhyamadikari platform, which means second class, right? So... which means full of spiritual substance. So we are challenged. I think we cannot just... Maybe that's a personal conclusion. I think we cannot just go with the flow. I'm a member of ISKCON, and now I just go with the flow, and it will all happen. I think we have to be a little conscious also and say and think of where... How are we going to give shape to our spiritual life, and how are we going to get at least to that Madhyam Adhikari platform which Srila Prabhupada desired? Okay, I'll end. Comments, questions, or...